Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is science journalist and author, Maren McKenna. Maren, welcome.
Hello there.
Hi, it's nice to have you on the show. I could not wait for this show. I'm so excited. You are a science journalist. So you've been on the show in January 2017. You're an expert in the overuse of antibiotics in humans and animals. And you published a new book called Big Chicken that covers modern history of the chicken economy and the disastrous use of antibiotics. I wanted to get into that because it's a fascinating book. I've been through it, and it's breathtaking, and it's important. But before we get into that, I wanted to just briefly, for those listeners who are not familiar with you, tell us about yourself and your writing career and what led to the writing of the book.
So thanks for having me back. It was a great conversation the first time around, so I'm really happy to return.
I'm happy to have you.
I'm a science journalist. I've been working for quite a while. I started out as a newspaper reporter, and for 10 years now, I've been writing for major magazines, Wired, the New York Times Magazine, Scientific American, National Geographic, and so forth. And my primary interest, I describe it broadly as public health, global health, and food policy. So I'm interested in why diseases occur and why they take us by surprise. And I'm interested in the unintended consequences of the decision-making we do around things like whether we're going to fund public health or whether we build surveillance systems to anticipate new diseases emerging and whether we were ready for the ways in which we inevitably were going to misuse antibiotics.
I love that phrase, surveillance systems. Can you put a little color into that?
Surveillance systems. Yeah, those are the systems that we use to give us, they're early warning systems, essentially, and they're built up of many layers.
Is this a network of epidemiologists, perhaps?
Well, sometimes it's a network of just of data. You know, let's say, for instance, that you feel flu-ish on a day. You're starting to feel like maybe you've got body aches and you've got a fever. Maybe you're a little sniffly. You're thinking maybe you have the flu. And if you're smart, you go to your family doctor. Well, if your family doctor is one of the sentinel physicians who have volunteered to report to your state health department and to the CDC, then your case of flu would get passed up the line then and end up in a database that the CDC maintains that when data is abstracted from it periodically tells that agency how the flu season is going in the United States. That's an example of a surveillance system, as are analyses of bacterial samples that are taken from patients who go into hospitals or taken from farm animals when we take them to slaughter. All of those are surveillance systems, and together they make up the early warning systems that tell us when something bad is coming down the pike.
Cool.
So as a journalist, it seemed, if you looked at my work, you would see that for about 10 years now, I've been kind of obsessed with the question of antibiotics very broadly.
You are. We covered that in January when you were on the show, and it was fascinating.
You know, how we got them, how we achieved them, and how we wasted them in both medicine and now in agriculture, and that's really what this book is about.
So how long did it take you to write the book?
4 years.
Wow. It shows, because it's incredibly dense information-wise and technically, and it's an incredible work of science journalism that, as you said, outlines the history of everything. And I want to get into this a little bit more detail. The book is subtitled The Incredible Story of How Antibiotics Created Modern Agriculture and Changed the Way the World Eats. There's a nice prologue in the book that sort of encapsulates the history starting in the 1940s and working its way through failed FDA efforts and then finally some modern efforts. Give us a recap from the prologue, and then I want to walk through some more details of the book.
So it has been pointed out to me that the prologue in some ways is a bit of a cliche, in that I go to Paris and I eat something and my mind is blown. And I guess
that
that's
was a
kind
cool
of
part.
A trope, right? Yeah, that people go to Paris and they encounter food and they experience it as though for the first time. But in fact, this happened to me, that I went to Paris, as I have now done many times since that day. And I wandered up to a very average street market in my neighborhood in the 11th arrondissement, and I bought a roast chicken from one of several roast chicken vendors whose booths run down sort of the spine of this quite large market. And it was amazing, this chicken. It had been spinning on the rotisserie since that morning, and it was coated in herbs and salt and pepper, and the skin was incredibly crisp and brown. But aside from all those sort of like literally surface attractions, the thing that was extraordinary about it was that the flesh had a profound flavor. A flavor that made me realize that I was eating an animal as opposed to sort of a featureless, not very well-defined hunk of protein.
And or rubber.
Yeah, it made me start to ask myself, why had no other chicken I'd ever eaten in my life tasted like this? And I don't think it was just the Paris effect. I mean, and what I worked through in the course of writing this book is that in the things we did to build the modern system for producing meat, we elevated a lot of industrial values for efficiency, for consistency, for cheapness, and for affordability of product.
That wasn't done in Europe so much.
No, well, it was at first, and then they backed away from it. And the fact that they backed away from it is why this was so delicious.
Yeah.
Because the things that we took out of the system when we elevated those other values are the things that create flavor. And so I sort of went on a journey, and as a science writer already interested in antibiotic use, I went on a journey to understand how antibiotics had inflected meat production in such a way that we ended up with consistent, efficient, affordable, flavorless protein. And the answer to that is that antibiotics entered the meat production system right at the beginning of the antibiotic era. And for decades since, some prescient scientists and reformers had been saying that this was a bad idea, that grave public health harm would result. And that now, at the end of this fairly dark story of multiple decades, there is some light at the end of the tunnel. There are some changes happening, which is really why the reason the book is about chicken is not just because of my French market chicken. It's because the history of industrial poultry production brackets the history of how we came to use and misuse antibiotics in agriculture, because chickens were the animals who got what came to be called growth promoter antibiotics experimentally.
Right. And now that became a big business, with millions of pounds of antibiotics being sold and big business interest.
That's right. So at the moment, according to the most recent federal data, which lags by a couple of years, so this is from 2015, we, in the United States in 2015, 34.3 million pounds of antibiotics were sold for use in farm animals, and almost none of those animals were sick. This is not a question of animals are sick and we are making them well. It's a question of antibiotics do other things to animals.
That was because, as I read early on, it was discovered that antibiotics created bigger, quicker maturing, plumper chickens, right?
What was going on there? They didn't in 1948, when the seminal experiment was performed, they didn't have the vocabulary to describe it as what we now know happened, which is they perturbed the chicken's gut microbiome. That is to say, the community of bacteria that live in their guts and in the guts of every living thing. These minuscule doses of antibiotics, far too small than would be needed to cure an infection, went into the chicken's feed and water, went into their guts, changed the balance of the antibiotics, of the bacteria that were in them, in such a way that the animals extracted more nutrition from their food, changed their metabolism, but at the same time created antibiotic-resistant bacteria in the guts of the animals that then exited the animals in a variety of ways and moved into the wider world.
And at the time, as you say in the book, nobody thought this was a bad idea.
It's
for everyone.
Such a strange story, and I mean, all time after time, I kept having this sense of this experience of what were they thinking? But what they were thinking, to give them their due, is that in the wake of World War II, they had a food system that had been gravely injured by the war. And in order to bring it back, they had to cut costs as much as possible. So the initial impulse here is to supplement newly cheap feed with cheap supplements that will somehow restore additional nutrition without raising costs.
Was this the oreomycin era?
This is. So oreomycin, which we know better now as chlorotetracycline, is the first of the entire tetracycline class of drugs. And it's one of the drugs that starts what we think of as the antibiotic era, which, you know, we were all born within the antibiotic era. So we kind of think that they've always been around. But in fact, they're pretty new. You know, and Alexander Fleming spots the first evidence on a petri dish of the thing that will become penicillin in 1928. Penicillin isn't turned into a drug until the early 1940s. And then after the war, you get in close together streptomycin, chloramphenicol, and the tetracyclines. And those are the drugs that start the antibiotic era.
Fleming did something good. He distributed his research to lots of different companies so that nobody had a monopoly. And then the companies in time got the idea, we should patent these things so we can solely profit from it, right?
So penicillin, alone of the antibiotics that we now rely on, was not patented. That is to say, the formula was not patented because it was so needed for the war effort that the American government courted or forced multiple companies into making it. Companies subsequently patented their different methods for making penicillin because it was all very sort of indie at that time, how to figure out how best to brew an antibiotic out of living organisms. That's kind of what defines an antibiotic, is it's a compound made by an organism as opposed to like a metal salt or an element or something like that. So subsequently, once they saw the extraordinary demand for penicillin, I mean, it's hard for us to imagine the ways in which penicillin changed the world.
Well, you described in your book about how in before World War II, if you scratched yourself on a rose bush or got cut, you could die or have a limb amputated.
Let alone if you had to have surgery. God forbid you had to have a surgery that opened the open cavities of your body, or had scarlet fever, or had pneumonia, or all the things that we now dismiss as unimportant because antibiotics made them unimportant. So when it was clear how lucrative penicillin could be, a bunch of other companies that to that point were only really making sort of patent medicines, over-the-counter medicines, all jumped into the process of looking for their own organisms that would make their own antibiotic. And the one that the antibiotic that starts this whole agricultural journey, chlorotetracycline, is made by a company called Letterly Laboratories, which is just outside New York City, sort of on the Jersey line. They make a drug, the drug chlorotetracycline. They patent it for human use in the spring of 1948. And by the fall of 1948, one of their scientists, Thomas Jukes, is already trying to put it into chickens to see what's going to happen. And on Christmas Day, 1948, he ends the experiment that proves that tiny doses of this antibiotic serve as a growth promoter in chicken. And within 5 years, farmers in the United States are giving 500,000 pounds of antibiotic to their animals. And now, as we said, it's millions and millions of pounds.
The miracles of modern science. All good, right?
Better living through chemistry.
Tell me a little bit more about Dr. Thomas Jukes.
You know, he died in the 90s, and I'm so sad I never got a chance to meet him because he left a really robust record of his thinking. He was what we would call today a science communicator. I mean, he was a scientist. He was a biologist, and he was from England. He migrated to the U.S. He ended up at the University of California working on sort of the dietary needs of chickens, and that's how he got hired by Letterly. But after his experiment proved growth promoters and they began to be taken up, he became a ferocious defender of his discovery. And to the end of his life, he was writing op-eds in the major science journals, in the New York Times, in pretty much anyone.
Just out of sheer cussedness, you said.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Insisting that there was no downside. And he was ferocious. I mean, he wrote articles denouncing Rachel Carson when Silent Spring came out.
Oh my.
He was ferocious about things like, using diethylstilbestrol, which later was found to cause cancer in the daughters of women who had taken it. And it was just, science was, in his view, an uncomplicated good.
Well, it's time for a break. This is a good place for us to take a minute off and hear from Kelly. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the rest of the story and the loss of perhaps consumer confidence in the food supply and then what we did. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us. This is a great story.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
And we're back. I'm chatting with science journalist Maren McKenna. So tell me how it started falling apart. In a few minutes.
The extraordinary thing. I mean, we were talking about how, good intentions and unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. To give the Jukes and his cohort in the 50s some credit, they did attempt to understand to some degree what was happening. And they believed that they understood that antibiotic-resistant bacteria were arising in the animals to which they were giving these antibiotics. What they never thought about was that the bacteria were going to exit animals. And it doesn't take very long after this practice starts for the society to start seeing the actual effect, which is outbreaks of antibiotic-resistant foodborne illness, Campylobacter, Salmonella, E. coli, which is a thing that has never existed before. And these outbreaks are quite large, and they are in many cases quite disseminated across areas, and it takes some smart disease detectives to put them back together and to trace that, in some cases, quite long and thin trail of evidence back to the farm.
You mentioned in the prologue that there was a horrific event with a Mr. Schiller and a case of salmonella poisoning. Was it singular outbreaks that were horrific and unexplained that started getting the alarm bells on?
Right. So Rick Schiller is a very recent victim. He is a victim of an outbreak in the United States of drug-resistant salmonella that went on from 2013 to 2014. But there are decades of outbreaks like that. And I want to be clear that the peril from misusing antibiotics in agriculture is not only foodborne outbreaks. There are other kinds of infections caused by drug resistance that's generated on the farm. But the first signal, because in some ways there's a more intuitive sort of linkage, is foodborne illness that happens to be antibiotic resistant. At the same time that antibiotics are being used more and more in agriculture, agriculture is changing. Food companies are becoming more larger and more consolidated and sending their products over much wider ranges, that these outbreaks get to be very disseminated. So Schiller's, for instance, even though it was a modern one, more than 600 people sick in 30 states and territories in the United States, and probably actually several thousand victims that were never identified.
And then there was the famous outbreak of hoof and mouth disease in England. When was that? That was in the 60s, wasn't it?
Right. So hoof and mouth is that is not an antibiotic resistant illness. But the reason that hoof and mouth is important is that there have been several very large historic outbreaks, but there was one in the 1960s. I actually was a child in England at the time, and I remember seeing the coverage on the television and how horrific it was. Smoking piles of carcasses and so forth. And what that did was to wake up to the dangers of the roads that meat agriculture was going down. And out of that, we get the first government control of farm antibiotic use, which is in England in 1969. And from that, we get the first attempt at control in the United States in 1977, which fails miserably because of political...
But did it succeed in Europe?
It did. Yeah, yeah. So wow. In England, England becomes the first country to control growth promoter antibiotics by a vote of parliament in 1971, inspires the Scandinavian countries to move in the 1980s, inspires a partial ban in the European Union, which didn't exist in 1969, in 1999, and then a full ban on growth promoters in the European Union in 2006. So for more than 10 years now, Europe and the United States have been on diverging paths of how we think about and how we control farm antibiotic use.
Is it safe to say that big business interests in the United States overwhelmed the FDA's ability to regulate?
Well, in 1977, which was before the Obama administration, the last time the FDA tried, you know, there was a reformist crew came in with the Carter White House, tried to change the rules at the FDA, and were beaten back by political pressure from Congress, sponsored by agricultural interests. And in the decades after that, time and time again, there was more and more scientific evidence that antibiotic-resistant bacteria were flowing from farms and causing a human health threat. But no matter how much evidence there was this persistent narrative in the veterinary pharma industry and the sort of big ag industry that you could sum up as no clear effect, more research needed. And that went on up to 2009, when a coalition of 20 companies and producer groups sent a letter to the Obama White House saying, once again, no clear effect, and more research needed. And in response, the Obama White House put in a new proposal for controlling farm antibiotic use in the United States that surprisingly was successful and went into effect in January of this year.
Was there a event or an outbreak or something that caused this enough consciousness that we turned around? Or scientists sometimes, you know, sound the alarm, but sometimes it takes, like you said, that hoof and mouth disease in England or some social cataclysm to, you know, get the government turned around.
I don't think it's so much really that there was any one single outbreak that was shocking. It's more that there had been many outbreaks, and each of them were shocking. And every time they were larger and larger. I mean, across the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, the CDC investigates time after time after time, larger and larger outbreaks of antibiotic-resistant foodborne illness. In fact, in one case, they actually managed to get one drug removed from the market, a drug called Baytril, which is functionally identical to the drug that we all take called Cipro. And there's so much Baytril resistance, which is to say fluoroquinolone resistance, showing up in bacterial samples from people. And it so clearly traces to the recent introduction of this drug, Baytril, that the FDA manages to get that drug removed from ag use. But it takes almost 5 years. And so all the veterans of that fight in the 1990s and early 2000s looked at what was going on, realized that they could not have a five-year battle for every single drug on the market, and came up with the strategy that the Obama administration ended up deciding on, which was to kind of ask companies to change, to persuade companies, to not force them, but to ask them to go along with a policy that would still, that by changing the labels on drugs, remove growth promoters from the United States. And it's really surprising in a way that all the companies went along with it, but there were so many other pressures around them at the time. More outbreaks, a nascent consumer movement, an activist White House, some suspicion that maybe the antibiotics weren't working as well as they used to, that they did in fact go along.
Are you sensing any reversal as concession to big business with the current administration, or are we still on the path to righteous
behavior? I think a lot of people are anxious about that, and it's a natural question to ask. That as the political situation changes from the attitudes of the Obama administration to the attitudes of the Trump administration, are we going to have a rollback? So far, the answer seems to be no. And I think it's no for a couple of reasons. The first is because the drug companies really did make a change. And this was the surprising innovation of the Obama administration strategy, was that instead of going after the demand side for ag antibiotics, which is farmers' use or production companies' use, they went after the supply side. They asked the drug companies to change their labels. And the companies did. And they, because they all did that, which is a, you know, kind of complicated change that involves internal company stuff, it seems less likely that they're going to change back. But the real reason, I believe, and I think the book lays out, the real reason that both the Obama administration moved and the drug companies changed, and also that major meat companies independently turned against antibiotic use, all of that is because, in my view, of this consumer movement that started rising about the year 2010, in which first very large healthcare systems and then very large school systems that buy meat for lunches, and then groups of activist parents, many of whom had lost children to resistant infections, and then chefs and farmers and other influencers and advocacy groups all got together and said to the meat companies, we do not want to spend our dollars on this anymore. And so out of that, you get, in 2014, Purdue Foods, the fourth largest chicken company in America, standing up and saying, we actually are practically antibiotic-free now. We've been working on this since 2007. And you get Chick-fil-A, the creators of the iconic chicken sandwich, mm-hmm. announced in 2014 that within 5 years they intend to be fully antibiotic-free.
Well, that brings up my next question. What percentage are we free? I mean, when I go into the grocery store, I see chicken. That's just, you know, normal stuff on the shelf. And then I see stuff that's labeled organic. So there's evidently, and I take it organic means antibiotic free unless it's otherwise labeled, right?
Well, that's a little tricky.
Tell me about that.
So here's where it's tricky. This is, you have to get down into the details of policies. So generally speaking, organic overlays antibiotic free, and also there are many other things in the organic rules that just generally make life better for animals. But in the case of chickens, the organic standard starts on day two of a chicken's life, which means that chicken could have been injected with antibiotics in the shell or could have been given antibiotics in its first day of life. And either of those are enough to perturb that chick's gut microbiome in such a way that antibiotic-resistant bacteria may result. So when people ask me what they should do to support this nascent movement, I ask them specifically to buy antibiotic-free. I know everybody, you know, right-thinking people want to buy organic if they can afford it, but it's really antibiotic-free that most gets us where I want to see us go.
Good to know. What about the term free-range? Does that have any value other than the joy of the chicken being able to run around instead of being caged up?
Well, for chickens, it's more common to hear people talk about pastured. And though that is not, to my knowledge, a legally defined term, you know, people who say that they are pasture raised generally mean that the animals are spending all of their daylight hours outdoors and then going under shelter at night to protect them from predators. Pasture birds and pastured eggs really are a different thing, because in order to be a pastured, to survive as a pastured bird, you need a bird that is more like the birds that our grandparents grew, that are not the fat, almost unbalanced, breast-heavy, white, docile broilers that grow in industrial sheds, but rather are more upright, have, you know, faster twitch muscles, can move around more, can flap their wings, and all of that results in a bird. They're often, often have colored feathers, so they hide a bit better. That results in a bird like my French bird that tastes much better, much richer, because they're getting a natural diet and they're doing their own pecking for insects and they're exercising and so forth. But it's on a bird that is of a significantly different shape and often lives to a different age than a sort of industrial system chicken does.
Are all pastured chickens antibiotic free?
I have not come across any pastured raisers that use antibiotics. Not that necessarily that is regulated, because most of these people are doing this sort of as a one-off. It's not as though they're within giant systems or giant corporations, but more that they are doing that, which produces a bird that is significantly more expensive, because they want to hold themselves apart from the products of the big high-throughput systems, and being antibiotic-free is part of that.
So we're coming up on the holiday season, and people are starting to think about maybe Thanksgiving and turkeys. Does everything you've talked about with chickens apply to turkeys, or are there differences?
No, it does. You know, there are industrial turkeys and there are pastured and small farm turkeys. And the key thing here is that both chicken and turkey are the ones that we eat today from the high throughput industrial scale systems are the product of decades of antibiotic use, but also of decades of crossbreeding. They're not GMO, they're not transgenic, they're just they naturally have been bred to bring in certain traits. And the consequence of bringing in those traits, which again for turkeys is like weaker legs and bigger breasts and a kind of docility and no interest in like flapping or moving around much, is that all of these birds are intellectual property. I mean, you can think of birds as like software or like seeds, you know, that they are. I think we've become accustomed to the idea of farmers, when they grow row crops, they have to go back and back to the companies in order to buy their seeds fresh every season because the plants don't reproduce true. That's true for modern broilers and modern turkeys as well. They can't physically reproduce. Turkeys can't physically reproduce because of the way their bodies have been changed. They have to be essentially artificially inseminated. So there are people sort of holding themselves out from this system that still protect the open source heritage standard bred genetics, but all of the birds that are within these systems, the genetics of chicken, all the broiler chickens that we raise all over the world, they belong to two companies. It was three when I was writing the book, but just this summer, one of the companies bought another one.
How much of what you've discussed in the book, Big Chicken, applies to beef?
So chicken is what, you know, I bracketed this story with the story of chicken because chicken so well illustrates its beginning and its end. But beef and pork, cattle and pigs, do both have this problem of routine antibiotic use. And in some ways, it's a problem that's going to be harder to solve for them because they're bigger animals. They live much longer. Remember, an industrial chicken only lives on average 42 days before we kill it. And they move around more in their lives. So they might be born on one farm, taken to a second, taken to a feedlot, and so forth. That means they are at more exposure to potential pathogens. So solving the problem of how and when we use antibiotics in those meat systems, in swine and in cattle, is going to be more challenging. But I still hope that they undertake it soon.
Okay, well, we're about out of time. I think we've done a really good job covering your book. What did I forget to talk about that you wanted to add?
The story that I think most exposes the cheerful, unthinking way we took up antibiotics in agriculture is the story of acronizing, which is this bizarre and lost episode that I think I uncovered, that from the mid-1950s to the end of the 1960s, we routinely dipped raw chicken and fish in a solution of antibiotics and put it in packages and sent it to grocery stores, because that would retard spoilage bacteria so much that it could stay in the cold case for weeks or a month instead of just for days. And there's such a natural ick factor to that that it's amazing to me that anyone ever did this. But they did it for a decade until finally consumer pressure turned against the whole idea of food additives in the late 1960s. And the reason that it was exposed was that some of the earliest CDC disease detectives worked on exposing it.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, we're going to have to bring this to a close. What a great story. Folks, this is an important book. It's a well-researched, awesome book, and it's terrifying in some places and awe-inspiring and very informative. I urge you to go to Amazon. We'll have it in the show notes again. And buy the book, Big Chicken, the incredible story of how antibiotics created modern agriculture and changed how the world eats. This has been an amazing show. Maren, thank you for joining me and telling me about this book. It's awesome.
Thank you so much for giving some exposure to my book. I'm so excited about it. I hope everyone reads it. And it's always great to talk to you.
I hope so, too. Tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
Sure. So the book itself is at bigchickenthebook.com. They can find me at marinmckenna.com on Twitter and Instagram. I am Marin, M-C-K.
Excellent. Excellent. Folks, I hope you enjoyed this adventure and informative analysis of the chicken industry. And go read the book. So we'll have to bring this episode to a close. Folks, we'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.